Have you ever found yourself in a tough conversation about faith, unsure of what to say or how to say it? Maybe with a skeptic, a friend, or even a family member? We want to help. That's why we're giving you a free download of 5 Steps to Having Better Conversations. This powerful guide will equip you to navigate faith discussions with confidence, wisdom, and grace, so that you can share your beliefs in a way that truly connects. Get your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Don't miss out. Start having better, more meaningful conversations today.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, the show that brings you conversations that matter every week. Today's debate is going to be on the fate of the apostles with Sean McDowell and Paul Enns. And today's show, recorded, like they all are at the moment, from lockdown from my home in Surrey. So if you hear any banging or thuds or children's voices in the background, well, I have asked them to keep it down, but you never know what's going to happen. It's been fun, actually, this last week, not just doing the Unbelievable show at the moment, but joining every weekday morning from 10 a.m. on Premier Christian Radio for a new show that I'm presenting with Andrew Phillips and Simon Tuck. You can hear us with a variety of guests from 10 a.m. each morning if you'd like to tune in then. And there's been some interesting stuff in the past week, actually. On that show, I spoke to Lou Fellingham and we spoke to other worship leaders this past week about the UK Blessing. It's a song that's gone viral on YouTube over the last week, in which I think about 65 or more churches came together to record this special song for lockdown. So there's been a lot going around on that one. You can actually see the interview I did with Lou Fellingham on the Unbelievable Facebook page. And also that ComRes survey. This came out just after last week's show went live. But really interesting statistics on the fact that 1 in 4 people in the UK apparently have tuned into an online church service since lockdown began, which, given that the average attendance probably in the UK normally is about 5% of the population, it is quite extraordinary. And also a survey suggests that more and more people turning to prayer during lockdown. So I'd be interested in your responses to that. I put up a couple of news stories about that on the Unbelievable social media. It's interesting the effect that this COVID-19 lockdown situation is having and the kinds of questions it's raising in people's minds. And it's been great to see some of your feedback on my talk on God and coronavirus that came out last week as well, plus the meaning debate we had over the weekend as well. We'll get to some of that later on in the show. Do make sure you sign up for more updates from the show. We're going to be reinstating the newsletter. It's gone a bit silent recently, but we'll be getting that back on track so that you get regular updates from Unbelievable. You can sign up from the show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. The app's available there as well. Videos, of course, you can find today's show over on YouTube. All our blogs and, of course, ways to give. If you'd like to support the show financially, that's always very welcome. And you'll get last year's Unbelievable Conference USA on video as well. And speaking of conferences, of course, this weekend would have been, under normal circumstances, the Unbelievable Conference here in the UK. Of course, that was not to be because of coronavirus. It's kind of weird, actually, to think, you know, the parallel universe of the normal life, the things that would have been happening at this point in the year. It's a strange one to think about. But nevertheless, even though we can't bring you that, I am excited to say that we are bringing you an apologetics webinar on Thursday, the 28th of May. That's at 3:30 p.m. in the UK. So if you're not in the UK, you'll have to work out when that is in your time zone. I guess it would come out at 10:30 a.m. Eastern time in the USA. Anyway, it's going to be on unlocking apologetics in the era of COVID-19. I'll be part of that, hosting that along with Pete Phillips, and our special guest will be John Lennox for that particular webinar. He, of course, recently released that book, Where is God in a Coronavirus World? A number of other special guests as well joining us for that. So if you'd like to register for that, that's for Thursday, the 28th of May, but you can register right away. premierdigital.info is the website to go to, premierdigital.info. And you click on the webinars link and you'll see that there's a number of other webinars that Premier are putting on in the coming months that you may be interested in registering for. Of course, if you're a ticket holder for the original Unbelievable Conference, as I've said, we will be honouring all of those with the next year's conference, where we hope to put on the same speakers, same theme and so on. Of course, anyone who can't take that up will, of course, be refunded in due course. But we are still bringing that together and hoping to bring you news on that in the not too distant future. But hope that if you're interest is piqued in that webinar, you'll join us for that on Thursday, the 28th of May. I'll make sure to leave the info for that in the links from the podcast today. Also excited that we're arranging a special Facebook Live edition of the Ask NTU Write Anything podcast. That'll be in early June, so I'll bring you more details on that next week. But looking forward to sitting down, remotely at least, with NTU Write to get some of your questions answered on Facebook. And just a PS before we get into the show today, I'm going to be doing something rather fun, but pretty important as well, on Sunday the 17th of May, in just over a week's time. I've got a lockdown hairdo, as many of us do at the moment, but mine really is out of control. If you've watched any of the recent Unbelievable videos, you'll know what I mean. And so it's time to take back control of the hair, and we're doing that in a pretty drastic way. My wife is going to shave off my hair entirely, going completely bald, more or less. And we thought we might as well do that and make a bit of money for charity as well. So if you would like to sponsor my charity head shave coming very soon, I would love you to get involved. It's raising money for a really important cause, Christian Aid. They are aiding, helping the world's poorest people. We've been big supporters of them in our church. They're going to be massively down on donations this year in Christian Aid Week because there are no door-to-door collections during lockdown. And so we thought we'd get creative and find a way of supporting them. So if you'd like to donate towards my charity head shave, you'll find links in the podcast info with today's show. So please do give generously. And why not tune in? You can get the live stream of this happening on Sunday the 17th of May. It'll be at around 12 noon UK, I say. So if you're in the States and you want to catch this live, you might have to get up early for it. And I'll make sure there's a link as well to where you can tune in to watch that. It'll be straight after our Sunday morning service that we live stream from our front room at the moment. So if you'd like to donate, a link in the podcast info, and you can donate to the charity Head Shave. For now, let's get into today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So, are martyred apostles good evidence for the resurrection? That's our question on today's show. Would the disciples of Jesus have been willing to suffer and die for something they knew to be false? It's often an argument used to defend the resurrection. Well, Sean McDowell wanted to find out what the scholarly evidence actually was for that claim, and so he did a PhD and wrote a book on the subject, which is the obvious thing you'd do if you were looking into something, isn't it? But Sean is an associate professor of Christian apologetics at Biola University. He's the author of several books, including the one I'm talking about, The Fate of the Apostles, based on his PhD thesis on the martyrdom accounts of the apostles. Well, recently, a video he posted on the subject was critiqued by atheist YouTuber Paulogia, aka Paul Enns, who also joins me on the show today. Paul has been critical of Sean's claims that there are reliable martyrdom stories of the apostles, or indeed that they qualify necessarily as martyrs. So we'll be looking at what we know about the deaths of the apostles, why they died, and whether it does provide good evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. So welcome along to the program, Sean and Paul. Great to have you both with me on today's show. Perhaps I could start with you, Paul, as a newcomer. And it's an interesting sort of name you go by on YouTube, and I never quite know whether I'm pronouncing it correctly. But where does it come from first?
Well, that's okay, because it's a Greek word, and I don't think any of us really know how to pronounce it exactly. It comes from 1 Peter 3:15, which the word in Greek is apologia, to give a defense, which is the name where Christian apologetics comes from.
Sure.
That particular Greek word.
I've heard of that Greek word. So.
But my name is Paul.
Slightly changed it. I see.
My name is Paul. And I actually do counter apologetics. I spend most of my time looking at apologetic arguments and trying to give the flip side of that, or perhaps just challenges to those things. So I thought, you know, hey, here's a clever play on words, Paul, apologia. So that's where my name was from. But a lot of people, because I used to be a Christian and I'm now not, I get a lot of suggestions that maybe I should revert back and be Sologia. That's the common suggestion I get.
I mean, I didn't get the Paulogia thing, so the Sologia thing would probably leave me well. But anyway, I understand it now, and that's actually quite helpful, and I see the connections. Just briefly, at what point did you lose your faith? When would you have said you were a Christian? What stopped you believing?
I started questioning my faith around 2015, so about 5 years ago, and that was after many decades of having been an evangelical believer. I was, for decades, I did youth ministry, music ministry, that kind of thing. So most of my life, I've been a Christian. It's just been in this last little portion where I've...
Yeah, that is a relatively recent, in a way, in the big scheme of things, development. But obviously, you've now swung, I suppose, quite firmly in the opposite direction, in as much as you are, as you say now, quite regularly producing these counter-apologetics type videos and so on.
That's fair to say.
Okay, well, maybe a subject for another day as to what, but I'm going to be enjoying actually hearing the discussion between you both on this particular subject. Welcome back to the program as well, Sean. Great to have you on the show. Well, it's great to have you on. You've been hosting your own discussions recently, I noticed, on your podcast. You had Josh Swamidas on to discuss, I think, was it with someone from Reasons to Believe?
Fuzz Rana on the historical Adam.
Great, yeah. I haven't had a chance to watch it yet, but I'm planning to. And
well, it will change your life, Justin, just so you know.
Okay, all right. Well, you couldn't have sold it to me better. I just don't want too much competition from you, Sean. You're a great apologist, and now you're probably going to turn out to be a great show host and dialogue moderator. And, you know, I just can't cope with this much competition in my life. So anyway, it's good to have you back on. Tell me, just remind us about this book, because I did have you on the show sort of the year after it was published. Now, that was an interesting one. People can go back in the archive to find out what happened on that one. But and I'm sure today's show will actually be quite different in tone and substance. Tell us again where this book came from and why you wrote it.
Yeah, so the last guest, I don't think had read or was familiar with any of my material. And I'm just not interested in having a discussion again with somebody, although I thoroughly enjoyed that discussion moving forward. And when I saw Paul G's video, I thought, you know what? We obviously differ, but he's taken my ideas seriously. He's engaged in the conversation. Here's somebody who's trying to put forth a counter proposal. This is how we figure things out. So I did a video response, and then you invited us on. I thought about doing it on my channel, but I thought, you know what, I'll give Justin the love on this one. He's been with me for many years, my UK connection. So the origin of this book, though, is, you know, I grew up in a Christian home, kind of like Paul did. We have that in common. Obviously, went different directions when we hit periods of questioning. I told my apologist dad, I'm not sure I believe this, not convinced by it. And he just was not threatened at all. He said, seek truth and know I'll love you no matter what. Well, to make a long story short, I am convinced Christianity is true for a number of reasons. Although initially in my journey, the question of the fate of the apostles was not a significant question. It was other questions I was wrestling with. This question really hit. I think the year was 2011. I was starting my PhD dissertation, or my PhD itself. Well, when you write a PhD, your ears are attuned to a good topic that you can enjoy, make a contribution at, and hopefully publish. And I was actually in Berkeley, and J. Warner Wallace was there with us with a group of about 30 high school students. And we had a mythicist come in and speak to our high school students, a friend of mine. And at one point, one of my students says, if Jesus didn't even exist, why would all the apostles die for this? And he looks back and he says, give me evidence any of them died for it. And the students kind of look at me and I'm thinking, I don't think I have as good of a response to this as I should have, given that I've used this argument in the past. So it hit me that night. I talked to J. Warner Wallace and said, I'm thinking about doing this as a dissertation. And Jay Warner, the detective, says, hey, I just bought two full boxes of books on this. I was thinking about studying it myself. You can have all the books. And it turns out that was just a drop in the bucket of what it takes to do a dissertation. So for 3 years, examined this. And I'd have to say, my point in this was not to prove that they died as martyrs. My point in this was not to prove the resurrection. That's not how you approach academic scholarship. My question really was, is there good reason to think the apostles died as martyrs? Is there good reason to think they suffered for their faith? And does this provide any evidence directly or indirectly for the resurrection? And I found myself pushing back on both sides of this conversation. I pushed back on a lot of Christians, even apologists who I think overstate this argument. I had one pastor in my research, he said, man, you're going to make a liar out of all of us. And I said, man, that is not my intention, but I think we've oversold this argument But I've also pushed back on skeptics who I think completely dismiss it without considering some of the good evidence we have if we frame this argument correctly. So came out of that 2015 academic book with Routledge Press, but I've done videos on it, done talks on it, have debates and discussions on it. And recently Apologia posted the video and I liked some of the things he said. So let's flesh it out.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad that you're both available to have that discussion on today's show. Obviously we'll end up just covering just some of the ground, not all of it. And I'm sure there'll be more opportunities in the future to do more on it. I want to get to the point about exactly who we're talking about when it comes to the apostles and which we do or don't have evidence for of their ultimate fate. But first of all, maybe we need to define a few terms. I mean, maybe the term martyr is a good place to start. And I'll start with you, Paul, on this one, because this was an issue you brought up in the video, that you don't feel that actually a lot of the examples that Sean gives necessarily qualify as martyrs. So how do you define a martyr in this sense?
Well, for me, when we're talking about martyrs, when I'm looking back at someone who's able to, their witness is supposed to be a guarantor of the resurrection, for example, there's three things that I'm looking for when I'm looking for a martyr. First is that the person claimed to be an eyewitness of the resurrection of Jesus. Second, that the person had a chance to save their life by recanting. And then third, that rather than recant, that they chose not to die. Now, I know Sean strays quite far from, he removes death from the equation entirely. But for someone like me, when I was coming out of my Christianity, I really took this whole idea of no one would die for something that they know is a lie to be a very serious challenge that didn't have to come from the Bible. I thought that was really good external evidence. So when you water that down to, you know, willing to die, that takes some of the bite out of it for me.
Okay. And so in a sense, you feel that the strongest definition, if you like, for the claim that's being made here is that it's people who were not simply willing to suffer or willing to die, but people who actually died and can be shown to have died
right,
because they were unwilling to recant their faith in that miracle.
And the one piece I think that Sean missed in the response he did for me is that the person claimed to be an eyewitness. And we don't have very many people who claim to be eyewitnesses. So when we're talking about, for example, James, the brother of Jesus, we don't have anywhere where James says, hey, I'm James, the brother of Jesus, and I saw a resurrected Jesus. Those are, for me, secondhand hearsay accounts from those people. So, you know, the first thing I need to do is first even, did they witness anything?
Right.
And then move on to this whole death thing.
As to, yeah, whether they died and if they died, well, obviously they did die, but right, whether they died as a result of proclaiming their belief in the resurrection and so on. So Sean, what's your, how do you in the book and generally, as far as the apostles are concerned, define martyrdom then?
So I'm glad this came up. And first off, Paul, one of the things I appreciate about your response is that you laid out your three criteria and then you tested the evidence based on that three criteria. In other words, you have a systematic methodology and it doesn't meet the criteria, so you dismiss the argument. I wish more Christians and skeptics would approach any issue this way, which makes our methodology clear. But it also won't surprise you that I differ pretty strongly with the methodology. So let's come back to the first one about them saying they saw the resurrected Jesus. And let's take criteria 2 and 3. So criteria 2, you said, was that they had a chance to save their lives by recanting. And 3, rather than recant, they choose to die.
Right.
Well, I would contest that you're welcome to hold this definition for your videos, in your life, in your ministry. It's a free country. And that includes the UK and Canada, where all of us are from. But I don't think it passes muster on a scholarly academic level. And I don't think it does on a popular level for people who think about this as well. And let me explain why. Starting with academically, one of the things I had to do in my dissertation is read extensive literature on martyrology. I had no idea such literature existed. And there's a huge history in the church and beyond about what is a martyr and how do you qualify a martyr. And I don't dismiss death entirely, like you said. I think death has to be tied to being a martyr. This is the consistent tradition. So some scholars have debated, what if somebody like Daniel Schack and his buddies get put through the flame but don't die, are they a martyr? The church would say no. What if somebody's hurt and they die, say, 3 years later, are they a martyr? That's where it gets a little sticky. I don't dismiss death as being necessary for their being a martyr. But what I would challenge is those criteria 2 and 3. Most scholars, as I've studied, including Thomas Westpedal, wrote his dissertation on this at Trinity Evangelical Seminary in 2005. And he walks through a history of martyrdom. And he says there are certain people that didn't have a chance to recant, but they're publicly proclaiming a message, knowing what it could potentially cost them, could have walked away from this message at any point. So if they're killed in a way tied to their religious practice, they could be considered a martyr. So the academic literature as a whole considers that clause as constituting a martyr. Now, let me make the popular point, that you can come back and give me your response. On a popular level, I also think we don't accept criteria 2 and 3. So for example, on July 26, 2016, some ISIS jihadis walked into, and you're probably familiar with this story, is a horrible story in France, and they slit the throat of an elderly priest by the name of Jacques Hamel. And I apologize to French listeners if I butchered that. While he was celebrating mass. I mean, it's just such a horrible thing to do. And a public article on this said, killing a Christian religious leader warns all members of the community that they are not safe. In other words, this is a religious act and a political act. It's both. Now, what's fascinating about this is there's no record that he was given a chance to recant while celebrating mass in front of people. In fact, according to witnesses, the last thing he said was, "Satan, go," and then they killed him. But what's interesting is Emmanuel Macron, who's the president of France, as well as Christians, including Pope Francis, and Muslims, and the press, all refer to him as a martyr, even though he didn't have a chance to recant. So my point being, you're welcome to hold that 3 criteria, and I think it's very helpful in the way you assess the martyrs so we see where you're coming from. But it's not the criteria used in academia, and I don't think it's a criteria used in popular circles either.
Well, push back on a couple things there. So the first would be, you know, the academia you've listed, and I actually went over chapter 1 of your book again after your video, just to make sure that, or the chapter on definition of martyr again, to make sure we're on the same page. And, you know, the academia you list tends to be evangelical academia. It doesn't tend to be the kind of, you know, scholarship in other areas of history. I think at the popular level, and I was starting to ask around, what does a person conjure when they think of a martyr? They're thinking of a death, and they're thinking of someone who's specifically dying, something you can pinpoint, as you say, not necessarily a recanting, but something where they, because of what they're doing, you know, is specifically the reason that we know they died. However, even if I grant you that we can allow, okay, so, and I don't necessarily, but let's say we grant that everyone who's preaching and is killed while they're preaching, you know, we can call those people a martyr. We don't have that kind of evidence for the 12 and for the couple of extra apostles that you include. We simply don't know what they were preaching. We don't know what they were doing. So not only do we not know whether they died, but I can't go with you that extra mile and say, we know what they were saying. We know why they died. I know, you know, you spoke in your video about how political deaths were necessarily ideological, but I think that's a stretch that I can't follow down. Like the death of James, the brother of Jesus, was specifically called by Josephus a political death. And I know you blur those together, but I just don't see how the preaching necessarily tied to it.
A very important point, which is, you know, to establish that they may well have died and been killed, you know, by someone who wanted them dead, but was it directly in response to the message that they were preaching or the faith that they held? I mean, at this point, I feel like we should at least mention a 2 or 3, let's say, of the specific examples you bring up in the book, Sean, and probably to lay out the fact that, you know, you don't see all of the stories that are out there as having equal validity and weight in terms of, you know, their historical credibility either.
Okay, so here's something important to keep in mind. For my case, it doesn't even matter that any of them died actually as martyrs, however we define a martyr. I had this conversation with William Lane Craig, and he agreed with me and said, we don't have to prove any of them died as martyrs, whether it's your definition or whether it's mine. Now, if we can show that some did, and I think we have good reason to believe, it strengthens our case, but that's not germane to the larger point that I am making. Now, the scholarship is by evangelicals that I cited, but the scholarship goes far beyond that. If you look in the chapters on persecution, I'm citing a range of different scholars talking about what persecution is, not just evangelical scholars that are here. So my point is saying you've got an overly restrictive definition of a martyr that is not popularly accepted on issues of martyrdom today or in academia. Now, with that said, we can start talking about the particular apostles and see if we have good reason to believe that they died, see if we have good reason to believe that they suffered. That's great. But what we plug into this equation, if we start with your criteria, which again, I don't think are accepted, scholarly or popular, we're going to get a very different response than if we start with a criteria that's more generally accepted among scholars and lay people about what a martyr actually is.
And of course, you know, this is where we differ. Like you went to, well, all these other scholars talk about persecution. Well, I accept, obviously, that, you know, lots of people were persecuted. What I'm most interested in, and because I care about, and I think you care most, how does this relate to the resurrection? And if we are saying that their sincerity is the guarantee of the resurrection, then it matters greatly which ones, you know, how many of them were there, and not were they eyewitnesses? And so when we brush aside point number one is, you know, whether they claim to be eyewitnesses, that's actually the part I really care the most about. Because how many people are we talking about here? And can we, if there's only a couple, if there's only, you know, enough, a handful or ones we can count on our thumbs, then we no longer even have to explain, when it comes to naturalistic explanations, you know, group experiences. Because we're talking about only a couple of people who are really sincere. And that's a whole different story than 12 were really sincere. I think you would agree with that.
So here's what I would argue. You can't move from the sincerity of the apostles to the truth of the resurrection. I've never said that. I make it very clear in my book. In fact, at the very opening pages, that the apostles' willingness to suffer and die doesn't prove the resurrection in particular or Christianity in general. All it does is it's one piece within a larger resurrection argument that shows they sincerely believed they had seen the risen Jesus and were willing to put their lives on the line for such a belief. So it counters the idea that they invented this story, that they made it up, they're lying, that it's a conspiracy to get some kind of gain out of it. That's my only point.
But if we go to, okay, so we saw that everyone who was a witness and everyone who was preaching, everyone who claimed to be an eyewitness was very sincere, which is actually, I can kind of get there. You kind of got me there. That everyone who was the eyewitness was sincere. The question is in the they in that sentence. And sometimes people plug in apostles and sometimes people plug in the 12 or the disciples in different various words. But it seems to me what we're talking about is a handful of people. It seems like, and possibly only two people. And when you get that far, then the number of people who can be sincere about it, but also be wrong, is what really shook me. Less, I with you, I kind of had to throw away the death guaranteed the resurrection. And I applaud you for challenging Christians to not overstate their evidence. And I like to challenge people on my side also not to overstate their evidence. But now what compelled me about this whole topic was maybe only Peter and maybe only Paul actually said that they believed it based on this kind of evidence.
Okay, so here's where I would push back, and I think this is where we might unpack some differences, is the only way to do history and know if somebody was a witness of something is not for them to directly say, I saw this personally in the way Paul does and maybe Peter does. We have a range of early sources of different genres, of different books, of different times, consistently saying from 5 years after the resurrection, all the way through into the second, third centuries, the only time we see a different narrative, that the apostles, including Peter and Paul and James, saw the risen Jesus. So if we're only going to accept a claim that we have in somebody's own words saying, I saw A, B, or C, we're going to toss out a ton of stuff that we know about history. Now, you and I agree we have that for Paul and maybe for Peter. I think it goes beyond that. In the consistent testimony in Acts, in Luke, in the other apostles, in the writings of Paul, in the early church fathers, that Jesus appeared to the apostles, and then that's the heart of the Christian kerygma, the belief, from the very beginning. There is no Christian faith apart from the earliest proclamation that Jesus died, buried, rose, and appeared to the apostles, and some of them are explicitly named. So I think you're taking a more critical response than most scholars would, determining what we can assess and know historically speaking. And that's why I'm pulling it back, saying, no, we have more confidence than just Peter and Paul in terms of these appearance stories. Thus, their willingness to suffer and die minimally shows they didn't make it up. They're not lying. They're not inventing this.
Well, the sources you list there, of course, some of those sources are I'm okay with. I accept the general scholarly consensus that Paul wrote seven of his letters, but I don't accept the entire New Testament as eyewitness here. For example, you list Luke and Acts. Even if I was to accept, which I do not, that a traveling companion of Paul wrote those books, everything that you are talking about appears in the first 12 chapters, which would be before Paul converted. And, obviously Luke, if it's Luke, the traveling companion of Paul, he's taking hearsay stories. At that point, for me, I understand, like, someone who doesn't necessarily take the Bible as evidence of the claim, but as claims. Those are sources where we have Luke, the author of Luke, getting these stories from who knows where, from what oral tradition. These are not firsthand accounts. So when I'm looking for firsthand accounts, it doesn't even have to be I, Paul, wrote this. And even if we accept First Peter as being written by Peter, he doesn't say he saw resurrected Jesus. And sorry, that's a lot to throw out. I should back off.
We're just coming up to our first break. I apologize for breaking in here, but I'd be interested to hear Sean's response to that, because I think this is an important point, is, initially asking, what do we know about who claimed to have seen the Jesus resurrected, and were those the people who then ended up getting killed for that claim? So we'll allow Sean to respond in a moment's time. We're doing a deep dive into an important, you could say niche, but it's still an important area of Christian thought and biblical study, the fate of the apostles. There's often an argument out there in Christian circles that the disciples of Jesus, would they have been willing to suffer and die for something they knew to be a lie? And the person who's done quite a bit of work looking into that is Sean McDowell in his book, The Fate of the Apostles, and being challenged on it today in today's show by Paul Enns. And we'll continue the discussion in just a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back. We're debating, are martyred apostles good evidence for the resurrection? Sean McDowell and Paul Enns are my guests today. Sean McDowell wrote a scholarly book on the subject, The Fate of the Apostles, and has been critiqued recently by YouTuber Paul Ogier, aka Paul Enns, in a video to which Sean responded. And I saw some of the back and forth and thought, hey, why don't we get these guys on Unbelievable and have it out on air and on video as well. By the way, today's show is available from our YouTube channel as well as the podcast and radio show as usual. So in that last section, Sean, Paul was saying essentially, yeah, but just how many of the accounts can we actually trust? He brought up the fact that he's got some doubts about the historicity of Luke Acts, who we don't really know who the writer is, where the sources were coming from. We may have literally only maybe two, maybe three at most, credible sources of people who claim they were eyewitnesses of Jesus' resurrection. And then, of course, we're going to have to debate what actually happened to them as well at some point in the program. So we're still here on the first sort of first stage of asking, well, were there credible eyewitnesses to the resurrection that did potentially get martyred. So where do you want to go with this, Sean?
So let me look at this in a couple different directions. And each of these we could spend extensive time unpacking. But I think when we look at Acts, I'm not willing to set it aside in the same manner that Paul is. I don't think most scholars are either. In fact, Edward Meyer, who is arguably the 20th century's most renowned Greco-Roman scholar of antiquity, he said, quote, "In spite of its more restricted content, Acts bears the same character of the greatest historians of a Polybius, a Livy, and many others." When we look at Luke and we look at Acts, we compare it to what we know with Josephus and independently with the writings of Paul, we see a remarkable matchup between them. Now, there's differences on a smaller scale, but we see a remarkable matchup on the bigger picture of it, which is pretty good confirmation. I mean, a significant amount of Acts scholars would say this is at least minimally a historical monograph, telling us a historical reconstruction of the early church. Even Bart Ehrman would agree with that. So willing to set that aside, there's a very good case, and I could listen to dozens of names of people and places and cities that Luke got precisely correct. The flip side of that, that's only one source. In Gary Habermas's research, he's shown that the vast majority of scholars agree that the disciples believed they had appearances of the risen Jesus. This is a, I forget his number, 90, 95% plus. And this isn't just an appeal to scholars. It's an appeal to the evidence and appeal to the scholars that the disciples all believed they had seen the risen Jesus. Now, that doesn't mean they all believed that he had risen. Some would say hallucinations, et cetera. We could talk about that. But the scholarly consensus is that the disciples believed that they had appearances of the risen Jesus. And there's a reason for this. It's because the appearance claims are early and they're multiply attested. So they're early, for example, in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, which I heard in one of your discussions, Paul, you can see it is probably 5 years from the time itself of, say, the death of Jesus. 5 year window, we have this creed that Paul says Jesus died, was buried, appeared to me, appeared to James, appeared to 12, and appeared to 500. The earliest record we have has the resurrection at the heart of it and the claim that Jesus appeared to James in particular. Paul says he appeared to him. He appears distinctly to Peter, and he lists the rest of the apostles. Now, that's not only in Paul's letters. We also see that in the Gospels. We see that in Acts. We see that in the early church fathers. So consistently, we have this claim that the first belief the apostles had, which is publicly proclaimed, this doesn't appear decades later in legendary material. From the earliest record we have at the beginning, these apostles are standing up saying, we've seen the risen Jesus. We will put ourselves in harm's way for this, which doesn't prove it's true, but it shows that they actually believed it. So that's where I would start to go with this.
Yeah, well, let me rewind a little bit. So Acts, of course, you know, people who are people who work at secular colleges who aren't bound by, you know, that the Bible is true and inerrant, actually think that Josephus was one of the sources. We know that the author of Luke Acts used many sources. They actually, most of them think that Josephus was one of the sources that he used in his book. So it doesn't surprise anyone that Josephus occasionally lines up with Luke when we feel that that's one of the sources that he used. The book of Acts really doesn't line up with Paul's missions, and we can go into that if we want to. I don't want to sidetrack, but I really don't think that Acts and the Pauline letters line up very well at all. But when we're talking here now about, you know, the First Corinthians Creed and all those kind of things, and Gary Habermas, you know, I've asked Gary this question. When you ask scholars, did the disciples believe it? Yeah, they did. But if you change it, did you say, did Paul believe it? And then did Peter proclaim it? And did, you know, you go down the line, did Peter, James, Andrew, Philip, Thomas, Bartholomew, Matthew, James, son of Alphaeus, Simon, son of, you know, did you go, when you go down the line, when you group them all together, they have to say yes, because Peter and Paul are well attested. But when you look at all the rest of them, the scholars don't agree when you list them by name.
Okay. Yeah, Sean, what do you say to that? I mean, I guess there's points there about, you know, Paul wonders whether Paul and Acts agree all that much. Josephus could be a source, therefore not surprising if it agrees in places with that. But I think the main point that Paul has here is, okay, you can talk about well-attested with a couple of names, but the rest, there's basically silence on as to what they did or didn't witness, and indeed the nature of their deaths, I suppose, in the end as well, which I feel we should get to at some point in the discussion.
But very quick. It's not a solid case that Acts just borrows Josephus. We see overlap, but when they overlap, things are described very differently. Some stuff is included, some stuff is left out. Doesn't have the marks of somebody who's just copying another document. That's not as said as I think you made it sound. But second, here's what we have. We have distinct references to Peter, Paul, James, and the apostles. We have this in multiple early documents that we've talked about. Now, people say, well, it doesn't mention Bartholomew. Well, it doesn't mention Thomas. So does this count? And to me, right now, a lot of people are watching this show, The Last Dance, with Michael Jordan and the Bulls from the 97-98 season. Well, if in one of these shows it shows up the Bulls that are late for a game, the announcer would probably say, yeah, Michael Jordan and the Bulls are late. Because really, everybody went to see Jordan, not everybody else. So then could you say, well, all we can conclude is that Jordan was late because it doesn't mention Scottie Pippen. It doesn't mention Kukoc. It doesn't mention Steve Kerr. It doesn't mention Cartwright. Therefore, we can only conclude that Jordan and some unknown group, now especially, we both say this, but the Pistons say and confirm this as well, in a public area in which people prefer or deny this, you would be over-skeptical to reject that the Bulls showed up unless you had some particular reason to think Kerr was not included in that group. So that's why the apostles as a group, we have good reason to think that Jesus appeared to them. There's no other early testimony.
But even those accounts, like you're talking about, like Paul's letters don't mention the apostles at all, other than in Galatians where he talks about Cephas and...
What about 1 Corinthians 15? What about 1 Corinthians
15? That's the 12.
The apostles.
That's a creed that Paul didn't get himself. He admits, I didn't witness this. I'm not a witness to this. This is a nursery rhyme. I will take that back. This is a creed that was learned that they, that I agree was early. As you say, I'm with you that 1 Corinthians 15 creed is early. But like Acts, after they choose Matthias and then there's Pentecost, even Acts doesn't talk about the rest of these people. Like, so all the only story I need to think may have been part of oral tradition as opposed to being witnessed by that person, you know, is the ascension, which of course, if I don't believe the resurrection, I'm probably not giving a lot of credence to Acts 1 ascension either. So like it's not as many sources. And then when you talk about the church fathers, you know, that's second century, third century stuff that isn't the kind of evidence I'm looking for. I'm looking for, because those are people attesting to people, things that they couldn't have seen, whether or not we can be confident that there's a large group of people, and I think it's like two or three, who were sincerely believing that Jesus rose from the dead. And then we're going out saying that they did it. I don't know.
Okay, so here's the way scholars will look at this. So when scholars are looking at a historical fact, we don't have to assume all of Acts, all John, all the Gospels are true. We ask, is a claim, an event, or a saying multiply attested in different genres and in different books? And when it comes to the appearances of Jesus, that's exactly what we find. So in Acts, we have Peter preaching this message of death, resurrection of Jesus, and the burial, along and speaking on behalf of the apostles themselves. He's the spokesman for them. We go to 1 Corinthians 15. The earliest source we have is a distinct reference of Jesus appearing to them. We have the four Gospels. And even if we only include Matthew, Mark, and Luke in one, we also have John. And then we have the early sources on top of this. So the claims that Jesus appeared to people, or at least the apostles believed that Jesus appeared to them, is early and it's multiply attested. That's why the vast majority of scholars will conclude that they at least had experiences that they believed were of the risen Jesus.
I don't want to get maybe spend too much more time now on the actual, I accept that you guys are going to have a difference of opinion on how reliable these accounts are and the witnesses and so on. I feel we must get to, before our time runs out, the evidence for the actual martyrdom accounts as well, because of course that's you know, equally an important part of this. Now, is it your claim, Paul, essentially, that in your view that we really only have any evidence, if any, for a couple of apostles potentially having been martyred for their faith? And you obviously dispute as well exactly whether they fit the criteria of martyr anyway. I mean, give us, I suppose, your best case scenario in your view as to who we might have some evidence for.
Well, I actually really appreciated in Sean's book, he breaks down at the end of each chapter, he talks about, he gives a rating about whether these people were probably out preaching, and a rating as to whether or not they specifically died in the manner that is commonly held. And most of them he lumps into a category called as plausible as not. And most of those I would consider, I just lower that down to like, these likely didn't happen. You know, if a lot of the sources, for example, on Thomas, if you want to accept the gospel, the Acts of Thomas, which is one of the main sources for that, then you also have to accept that Thomas was like Jesus's twin brother. Like, there's weird things in all these cases. So I'm with Sean. I just lower everything. So when he says as plausible as not, I say not plausible. He has as probable as not. Those are the ones where I kind of look at it, but to me, those feel more like traditions. The ones where he, and of course, we both agree that John, and there are several Johns, but the John who is said to have written the book, the Gospel of John, he said to have lived as an old age, so no martyrdom for him. I think we agree on that. And then he has a category of people that he puts into highest probable, if I remember correctly, highest possible probability, and those are James, the brother of Jesus. Oh, no, he's in very plausible. It's James, the son of Alphaeus, right? You have the highest possible, Paul, highest possible, and Peter's highest possible. So while I actually agree that we have good sources, because I think they come from outside the Bible for Paul and for Peter, that they were probably both killed under Nero. We don't know if the fire was really set and what all the circumstances were there, but under Nero, those two probably were put to death. And then James's brother. The brother Jesus comes from Acts, he accepts Simon, son of Zebedee, because it comes from Acts, which I reject, but I'm still willing to give it some high clearance. So that kind of lays out, I guess I'm with Sean on all his assessments.
Except you just
I lower them all down.
Right.
Okay. And then when it comes to the ones that are really strong, when it comes to Peter and with Paul, my contention is that those were not necessarily, you know, situations where they were killed. Let me back this up. I actually believe that both Peter and Paul were very sincere. Those are the two that I actually accept. So I'm with him on the evidence. I would actually stand side by side with him to say, those two existed. Those two died believing what they were saying. Mm-hmm. Sean, let me throw to you. I said a lot of words, and I'm not sure it made a lot of sense.
That's fine. But I think you've laid it out pretty clearly that you've helped to kind of give the gradations.
And hopefully, I didn't make any mistakes in there because that's from memory.
Well, let's ask Sean himself.
First off, thank you for reading the book and for being careful trying to get the assessments right. You did a good job. Let me just clarify a couple. I would say of the 12. Meaning the original apostles, I would say Peter and then James, the son of Zebedee, we have high or very high probability they died historically speaking. In the group that I studied, but outside the 12, I would include James, not the son of Alphaeus, but James, the brother of Jesus, and Paul in the highest level of probability. Now, on some level, more probable than not, I might put Andrew and Thomas. And the rest are just, I think, inconclusive. So whether that's less than half, it really doesn't matter for my case. I don't think we can historically assess those traditions with any degree of confidence. But I'm not willing to concede that only Peter and Paul have a sincerity that can be established here. That's not something I'm willing to concede. But I do stop and I say it is very interesting that arguably the two most important founders after Jesus of the Christian faith. Paul, who wrote 13 letters, fine, you concede seven. Peter, who is mentioned more than any other apostle in all of the traditions, in Scripture and out of Scripture, you can see they believed Jesus rose from the grave, were willing to suffer and die for that belief that Jesus had risen. Even if I concede the rest that I don't, that's pretty powerful that two of the most important figures are willing to go to the grave because they really believe Jesus had them.
But that's actually the heart of my naturalistic explanation for this whole thing is that we have two people who, for whatever reason, came to believe this and deciding that Peter early on and Paul later on after he was persecuting people and probably felt really guilty about that. And Paul very much describes what he saw as a vision, you know, and depending on whether the Acts accounts or people saw things or didn't see things, you know, in my hypothesis, what it came down to was we really can be confident about two guys. They're the ones who are prominent. And if they were sincere, which I've now come to believe those two were probably sincere, then we don't really have to go into crazy explanations about group hallucinations or group appearances and all those kind of things. Those don't have to come into play anymore. We just have to explain how two people came to sincerely believe something.
Okay, so your naturalistic hypothesis, we should come back on some time and discuss your legendary hypothesis. I watched your video. I thought it was interesting.
Okay.
So minimally, I'm saying, fine, we have two people who really believe they saw Jesus, two of the key spokespeople for the Christian faith who proclaim, teach theology, write books in the scripture. That's pretty significant as it is. One that traveled with Jesus during his life, part of the 12, one that was outside the 12, who was persecuting. So they're coming from very two different places. Both think this is so true. They lay their lives on the line and are not lying about it. So that's significant. But the other thing I would say is we see right away that this message that Jesus is God and Caesar is not the kind of message that would easily be believed by people in this Jewish culture who had every reason to resist it. Not every reason, that's probably no meant. Believing it would put them at odds with not only the Roman culture, but put them at odds with, say, many of religion at the time. It's almost like if you need to explain Peter and Paul, everybody else falls in line. I'm saying no chance. There's no chance. 60 years later, and I can document this, there would have been 1,100 eyewitnesses of the ministry of Jesus left. Within 30 years, there would be over 20,000 eyewitnesses to the life, ministry, or death of Jesus left. People could investigate this. So to explain away the beginning of the church, you've still got the writings of John, you've still got the writings of James, you've still got so many other testimonies here that even conceding Peter and Paul wouldn't give us close to explaining the origin and explosion of this church.
A few things. One, I actually want to step back and just let everyone sink in that I think you would agree that evangelicals, it's probably a bad thing to do to overstate all those cases that you gave on the band, right? Like it creates people like me when you set an expectation that we know the grisly deaths and that, you know, that we can hang our hat on those. That's probably not something Christians should do.
No, I've never done that.
Yeah,
I
know you haven't, but people in my life have.
Christians should do that.
Yeah.
100% that's agreement with us. Yes.
So I didn't want to let that slide by without, you know, sort of getting that on thought, on record. I guess where you and I differ is in terms of the plausibility of whether a legend can grow. I mean, all the time we see, you know, religion after religion, you presumably don't think are true. They grow, even though they're not based on facts and they're based on things that theoretically could be checked. This whole, like the 500, some of whom are probably still alive, and I don't know if that was written in the 30s or the 50s, that particular fragment of the sentence. I still don't understand how someone's supposed to go to Jerusalem and say, go check out that there's 500 unnamed people who witnessed the thing 20 years ago. Like if I said that 20 years ago here in Calgary, that there was a concert out in the woods, and yeah, 500 people saw it. So come to Calgary with roughly the same size as Jerusalem, you know, and verify that. Well, how do you do that? How do you go door to door and like find one of these 500 people? And not only that, we also know from Woodstock and other events that you start talking about people, people start to think they were there. So you probably could find, you know, a handful of people. So I guess I'm just not as skeptical as you that this stuff can grow.
Let me jump on the 500 here. Okay. And in some ways we are getting a little bit aside,
right?
But I think it's actually easy to go find the 500. I just did a interview on my, I did an interview online, and I was interviewing the father of Timothy McVeigh, who was the Oklahoma City bombing, and the father of one of the victims. And because of their Christian faith, a reconciliation that they had together. Well, Timothy McVeigh's father lived in New York, and Bud Welch lived in Oklahoma. So he's like, how do I find this person? Well, he basically gets in touch with a nun in New York who knows a person who knows a person, and very quickly they're in contact with each other. It's actually not that hard if there's 500 people to ask around, to do research, to do investigation. And the way it's written in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul says this in such an early time span in a public forum, saying, if you don't believe me, go check it out. So my only point is, my case doesn't rest on the 500. I don't think I mentioned it once in my entire book, apart from the quote in 1 Corinthians. But, and this is where we differ. I think you're taking a hyper skeptical approach to this. And you might think I have a hyper trusting approach to this. That's fine. Methodology really makes a difference here. And this came clear to me. I watched a debate that you had, and I thought this was interesting, where, let me see if I read it correctly. This is a debate on the resurrection on your website. And let me see what I find here. You said, what would convince me? Quote, the requirement of evidence is so high. If I saw an appearance of Jesus, I would first question my mental faculties. I would question whether this vision was really real. And I read that. I thought, okay, he is coming from a hyper skeptical position, and you're free to do that. But that's not how scholarship operates. That's not how a lot of New Testament scholarship operates. When we look at who the apostles are, how many they're willing to suffer, their willingness to die. Now, on the flip side, I think, as you point out, you and I have this in common. I think there's also been a hyper trust by many Christians who read fathers and says, hey, they all died as martyrs, and they proclaim it. Well, I've met that claim in the past, so I repent on this show from making that before I did my research. That should be corrected as well. So I'm kind of standing in the middle saying, Christians who have overstated things, you need to ratchet it back and be faithful to the evidence. But I also think there's reason to have this hyper-skeptical position and reject them that are early and consistent and by the vast majority of scholars. That's where my pushback would be.
I think the one thing that I want to make clear is, though, like, I do accept some of the documents. I accept that Jesus existed. There's seven letters of Paul that I feel are written by Paul and absolutely have to be reconciled. I am not in some fringe of weirdness that, you know, is beyond this. But, you know, historical...
But you are a cartoon character online. I mean, you've got to admit...
This is true.
That contributes a little bit to it. Come on, Paul.
A very muscly cartoon character.
Yeah.
I know.
Well, that's a different really story like for another time. Yeah, I apologize for what you have to see today. That's not as cute as Sean. But when it comes down to it, like... What we can't get to historically, and this is just going to be philosophically different, is can you get to a miracle? Like you specifically, when you talk to me about being hyper-skeptical, if I saw Jesus in front of me, like that's either a miracle or I'm seeing something. Like those are the two options. So it only makes sense to me. I can't imagine, you know, Sean, if someone from your congregation came and said, you know, I saw Jesus appeared to me last night, you would probably at least in your head say, well, perhaps this was something you imagined and perhaps it was real. You'd at least put both of those options on the table.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's hyper skeptical to at least want to go through the mental exercise of saying, did I have bad pizza? Did I like, are there factors? Am I overtired? Like, are there factors that may have contributed?
Okay.
So just like,
That's fair. And look, I'm actually naturally a skeptic. I question things. If someone comes to me and says, hey, I saw a miracle in Jesus, I'm like, yeah, give me some evidence. So I'm skeptical like that. But if I had multiple people that I knew came to me, and then I remember that said, oh, somebody predicted this on multiple occasions, and then I have all these different lines of evidence indicating Jesus appeared to somebody, and then somebody is challenged with this, they say, you know what? I'm going to preach this, and if it gets me thrown in jail, it gets me thrown in jail. I would say, gosh, that person really believes it. So your claim about history getting to a miracle, that's fine. We're not talking about whether history can study the miraculous. I don't think the deaths of the apostles get us to a miracle. I never say that in my book. All I'm saying is they sincerely believed Jesus appeared to them. In fact, I'm not sure what else they can do. You and I are both skeptics, Paul. People say stuff to us all the time, and I can tell we are both wired like skeptics. But to me, when somebody says, you know what, I'm willing to suffer for this, I'm willing to say this even though it costs me something, not because of something I personally gain, that's where I stop and I say, okay, huh, you really believe this. Tell me about that. And that's the consistent record we have of the apostles. So it doesn't prove it's true.
Well, it's the consistent record we have of two of the apostles. And that's where you and I...
The group of the apostles. The earliest record is he appeared to the apostles. And James and Peter and Paul are specifically mentioned in the very first document that we have.
We're going to have to go to our final break, gents. I'm really enjoying this conversation, though. Thanks for keeping it so spirited and lively. And such a good-natured one as well on today's show. Asking, are martyred apostles good evidence for the resurrection? We'll be back with the final part of today's discussion in just a moment. Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of the show, recorded as ever from lockdown at my home in Surrey. So if you do hear a few bangs and thuds and children's voices in the background, you'll know it's just the kids. Despite me trying to get them to keep it down, it's sometimes difficult, a bit of running around happening as I speak. Thanks to all those who've been in touch, and we're going to hear some of your feedback towards the end of today's show. Lots of the recent shows, especially that one on meaning last week, where do atheists get their meaning from, have sparked your interest. I did get this lovely message on Facebook from Audrey Bartosh, who said, just wanted to drop in a kind word. Have been really enjoying your show lately. Please keep up the good work. So nice and refreshing to see someone having kind, respectful conversations with atheists. Praying for you and your work. God bless. Thank you, Audrey. Lovely to hear from you. If you want to get in touch with the show today, do email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I can't guarantee to be able to read all the emails we receive. I do read them all, though. I can't be guaranteed to read them out, is what I should have said. But I do read them all. I do see them all, and very often respond to those as well that need a word back. So that's the email address. You can also, of course, find the show on Facebook, facebook.com/unbelievablejb. If you want to comment there, I'm more than likely to see a comment underneath a post or a show, or indeed simply message me at the show page, and I'll see that as well. You can tweet me, of course, as well, @unbelievablejb. I was pleased to be on the Twitter this last week with Glenn Scrivener and to appear on his podcast, his Speak Life podcast. I've posted that up on my social media as well, if you'd like to go and listen to some of the conversation we had. Bit of sort of behind-the-scenes banter, actually, with Glenn about what happens sometimes with some of these shows that get lined up for Unbelievable. He, of course, was a guest on the final edition of our Big Conversation series, of course, and you'll hear me talking to him about our hopeful plans for the next season of that as well. So there's a couple of things to go and look at, ways to get in touch, and we will be hearing some of your feedback towards the end of today's show. Just a reminder that, excited to say, we've got a apologetics webinar from Premier coming up on Thursday the 28th of May. It's at 3:30 p.m. in the afternoon in the UK. Unlocking apologetics in the era of COVID-19. My special guest will be John Lennox. So if you want to register for that, premierdigital.info and click on the webinars link. Let's get back into today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of the show. A really interesting discussion today, looking at the fate of the apostles. Were the early followers of Jesus martyred for their belief in his resurrection? That was the claim that was being examined by Sean McDowell in his book, The Fate of the Apostles, which he published a few years ago on the basis of his PhD, and questioned recently in a video by YouTuber Paulogia, who is Paul Enns, who joins us also on today's show. And just in that last section, you know, again, Sean was saying, but look, it's remarkable, isn't it, that at least on two of these examples, you seem to be able to concede that they were sincere in their belief about having seen the risen Jesus, and that they were probably killed as a result of that belief, let's say, Paul. Now, in a way, you know, that alone says you don't believe they were liars. You don't believe, and they didn't die for something they knew to be a lie. They sincerely did believe that this was the case. It seems to me, though, that your point as, you know, as a skeptic is to say, well, but on the basis of two people having this belief that they were willing to die for, is that enough realistically to not posit a more likely thing that they, you know, had some bad pizza or whatever the equivalent right. example is for them, that they just misinterpreted something. They, you know, I mean, it's a pretty big mistake to make, obviously, if in the end it causes, you know, it means you lose your life for the sake of it, that you happened to be wrong, that Jesus had actually resurrected. But you still think that's a more likely scenario ultimately than the miraculous one.
Yeah, and as Sean was talking about in the last segment, you know, he went back to they were willing to suffer, all those kind of things. But if they weren't eyewitnesses, it doesn't matter. I think Sean would agree with me, for example, like the people who flew into planes on 9/11, they died for something that was a lie, but they didn't have opportunity to know whether it was a lie or not. So what we really care about is which people were in a position to know that whether or not what they believed to the point of suffering or to the point of death was a lie. And I guess that's, for me, where this whole argument fell apart and where it got narrowed down to these, really, there's only two guys that I think we can attest for that. But I do want to, if I can, stray a little bit to another topic he touched on. And he actually quoted his friend, Jane Werner Wallace, the cold case detective, and talked about how there are basically three reasons why, you know, someone commits a crime. That, you know, it's either sex, money, or power is the quote, I believe, that Sean used. And I guess for me, you know, the fact that a fisherman from Galilee, you know, after having had all these experiences, having crowds around him and all these kind of things, it feels like going back to fishing is not the best way to make money. And all we can debate about whether or not the disciples actually ended up earning a living. It seems like Paul was at least earning somewhat of a living. But in terms of power, when I was in church ministry, when I was in youth ministry, I saw over and over, it only takes the smallest piece of power for people to lust after that power. So you put someone in charge of the bake sale table, that person is all in on the power of that bake sale table. You put someone in charge of, you know, making sure where people are going to sleep. Well, they take that kingdom very strongly. It feels to me like these apostles, these disciples, you know, got a taste of what it was like to be popular. I used to do worship leading for Promise Keepers, and I still remember the difference between doing Promise Keepers events for like a couple, you know, few dozen people versus once I did it in a stadium of 12,000 people. I will always remember that, because the power that, even though I had no power, I'm one of, like, you know, people on stage, whatever, I had no power, but I had a taste of what it was like. It sure makes sense to me that what the apostles may have been experiencing was some semblance of power, some semblance of matter. I have a tiny YouTube channel, medium-sized YouTube channel, whatever it is I have. I still occasionally get this sense that, hey, there's a few thousand people listening to what I say, and that's enough. Like, I, you know, would I suffer and die for that? Not necessarily, but there is an element of motivation for these people that isn't purely that they necessarily believed it, and that they didn't maybe want to buy in, like James.
That's a very interesting point, and one I hadn't particularly considered, but in a sense, the as you say, they went from relative obscurity to, at least within the Christian community, being very significant figures, and might that alone, I suppose the question is there, Sean, have been enough to have made them hang on to this belief even in the face of death, even if actually they weren't really sure whether it really happened or not.
So in my response video, I say J. Warren Wallace, cold case detective, who's never lost a case. Every case he did, he says people are motivated by sex, lust, money, greed, or power. Those are the big three. And so we look at the disciples, and we see no evidence that they're motivated by sex. Jesus treated women with nothing but charity and kindness. There's no evidence that they're motivated by power. So Paul just told a story about how people can be motivated by power. This was an assertion without any evidence that this is actually what motivated Peter and Paul, by the way, who had seen Jesus in the flesh, lay down his life, wash their feet, and live a life of self-sacrifice or money. So this story is, honestly, it's an assertion.
But I would put the story on the same level of...
Now, hold on.
The same level of your story about James, though. Like,
let me finish.
Sorry.
You said in the church, people will have power because they tell a bake table. Yeah, well, you tell somebody, hey, we're going to throw you to prison, and we're going to threaten you if you don't give up that bake table. Of course they're going to give it up. That's totally different than the kind that we have with the apostles. And by the way, your YouTube channel has thousands of people. Your YouTube channel is bigger than the church was for decades. So this kind of power didn't exist until the movement had already started and the ball was well down the road. So that couldn't explain the beginning of their movement unless you're starting now and reading something back in that there's no evidence existed at that time.
And just before Paul comes back in, I mean, the other side of this as well, I suppose, Sean, for you is that it's not just that they didn't have actually that many followers in the grand scheme of things, but that they were also under significantly more pressure for being Christians than simply going with the either Jewish culture or pagan culture or whatever it was that was around them, that was a significant disincentive, if you like, in that culture to actually hold on to that kind of belief system.
Yeah, they're beaten, they're threatened, they're thrown in prison, and they're outed. So it's the opposite of power. It costs them something. That's essentially my argument.
Paul?
I guess, you know, yes, I told the story. That's exactly how I feel when you say things like that James, the brother, James son of Alphaeus, was definitely killed because of Jesus, when really the text does not say that. The text says that he was killed, put to death by the sword, and then you present this whole story of how, well, obviously he was going around preaching, and obviously he was going around doing this. That's not obvious to me. It's not recorded. It's an inference. Exactly the same as the kind of inference I gave. So I I'm going to take that criticism on board because it is how I feel often when you are presenting things that are not historical. You normally stay in historical, but sometimes you stray. You give these inferences that I don't feel are covered in the text. So I will take that on board because it's a frustration of mine.
Just give me this example you're mentioning, though, because we haven't had that many actual tangible examples here of the instances of martyrdom. So James, the son of Alphaeus, is this example.
So in if I remember correctly, it's Acts chapter 12, and Herod is rounding people up, and the entire sentence is along the lines of he had James, son of Alphaeus, put to death by the sword. That's the whole story. That's what we have. Then, you know, we don't know that he was out preaching. We don't know, because the earlier passage doesn't say that James is out preaching. We don't know that he was professing that he saw Jesus risen from the dead. We have this creed that says that that's what happened, but we don't have it in his own words. Even if I accept the book of James as written by James, he doesn't say it in the book of James. So, you know.
Okay, let me jump in here. We've conflated three James.
Oh, sorry.
It's not James, the brother of Jesus, who wrote the book. It's not James, son of Alphaeus. It's James, son of Zebedee, who's in Acts 12:2, who was one of the closest apostles to Jesus. Now, you're right that we have to make historical inferences, but all historical inferences are not the same. To assert that Peter and Paul and the other disciples were motivated by power like somebody with a bake sale is a complete inference without any evidence. When we go to the apostles, what do we have? We have the earliest message that is preached consistently is that Jesus rose and appeared to them. We see them being persecuted and treated harshly for this. and we see James, the son of Zebedee, put to death. Now, by the way, most scholars will concede that that's a straightforward execution account, because when you read the account of, my mind just went blank, who was martyred in Acts 6 through 9. Holy cow, my mind went blank. Stephen? Not one of the 12s.
Stephen?
Thank you. Stephen. My goodness. Stephen, some scholars will say this was totally flowered to make it look like Jesus. Well, you look at the story of James, son of Zebedee, and it reads like a straightforward execution account. And in Craig Kinger's commentary on Acts, he goes into detail and he says, when we look at other execution accounts recorded in history during that time, this is the way that it reads. So we know the apostles claim to see Jesus. We know we put themselves in harm's way. I have at least this one source, and I would argue other sources, arguing that he is put to death, and their proclamation was, by all accounts we have, that Jesus had risen from the grave. Is that an inference of a kind? Sure. But that's not a blind inference. That's an evidential inference.
What I'm taking from that is that, for you, the context in which that execution summary happens is clearly in the context of what the Christians were doing, and therefore the execution is as a result of that. It's not as though he just, you know, disagreed with, you know, his favorite football team and decided to put him to death.
Think about it. The apostles are following a leader who was martyred. Jesus said, pick up your cross and follow after me. And this is multiply attested in all of the different gospels. They're proclaiming a message. They also had John the Baptist put to death. At this time, Stephen is put to death. So whether or not Paul and I can differ over the technical term of martyr, for this, in a sense, is really secondary. James is preaching a message that was unpopular, put himself in harm's way, put his life on the line. There was political motivation for this. I think you're right about that, Paul. But that cannot be separated, as it can't be with Jesus, from the religious proclamation that the apostles were making. Therefore, they're not inventing this. They're not making this up. All I'm saying is they're preaching something they think is true.
We'll go to a final one, if you would, from you, Paul, because we should start to wrap this up. But I want you to give you a chance to respond there, and then we'll have
no trouble. I guess it's just the same. It's the same pushback that, you know, you backed it off to say this was happening to the apostles. Therefore, it was happening. Therefore, it was happening with James, son of Zebedee. And it's like, well, I would just love to. I wish we had a passage somewhere that said James, son of Zebedee, was doing these things, which we just don't. So,
well, I guess it's one inference versus another in this case, and you obviously feel it's strong enough in the context of what's going on in the lead up to that.
Surely. If I don't accept the gospel at its word, like if I'm not accepting the Bible at its face value, if someone's coming to try and rebuild these things, it's not a strong enough case historically.
We're going to have to start to wrap things up. So, I mean, just general thoughts at this point, then, both of you. I'll start again with you, Paul, to say what I think I valued, and Sean has evidently valued as well, is that you're willing to take it seriously. You don't just dismiss out of hand the accounts. You're willing to look at the historically. You obviously come at it. Your level of skepticism, let's say, is ratcheted a bit higher with some of these issues, as we've kind of found out in the course of this. But for you, none of it presumably comes in at a level which gives you confidence to say that's a good piece of evidence for the resurrection. I mean, is that where you would land at the end of it?
That is where I would land. And so, you know, I did have to come in and come to learn and accept that historically, probably we can say a few things, but not as much as maybe I would have when I was a Christian. And I probably have to make the same confession that Sean did. When I was a Christian, I probably overstated these cases. But yeah, and for me, it bleeds into this cumulative case that is the resurrection. I think we would both agree that the case of the resurrection does not hinge on this point in any way, but it is one. It's one potentially important point outside of the Bible. If you could potentially show outside of the Bible that all these things happened, that would be really strong for someone like myself. Unfortunately, when I went to investigate it myself, it didn't come up as strong as it would need to for me to overcome some of my other doubts.
Final thoughts from you as well, if you would, Sean.
Yeah, Paul, thanks for reading the stuff. Thanks for taking it seriously. Thanks for pushing back and helping me think this stuff through. I think our stories just illustrate common research into this question, and you lean more towards the skeptical side, not convinced by it. I've said, yeah, there's been overstatement here, but if we pull this back, like you said, this doesn't prove the resurrection is true. But here we have this group of the apostles, some specifically mentioned by name. In every early source, the claim is they had seen the risen Jesus and they intentionally put themselves in harm's way. I can't convince myself that they made this up or that this is a conspiracy or that they're lying about this. Now, by the way, if none of these stories go through and are successful, it doesn't prove Jesus didn't appear to them. All it proves is one argument for this doesn't work. But fortunately, when we look at the historical evidence, I think the argument does show that they sincerely believed it and were not making this up.
Well, look, it's been great having you both on. Really appreciate the good-natured way in which the discussion's been had. I will, of course, make sure there are links from today's show, both via the YouTube channel, the podcast, and elsewhere, to both of the videos that have been referenced already today and both of your channels and where we can find out more about you. It's time for me to sign off and say thank you very much, Paul, or Paulogia, on YouTube, and Sean McDowell. Thanks both for being with me today on the show.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Apologies that once or twice during the course of that, the link with Sean was a little bit interrupted. We had some connection issues once or twice, but I think it held up pretty well in the end. And I'll make sure there are links to both of them and some of the resources we were discussing from today's show. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable to get today's show on podcast. Do send it on to others. It's great when new people discover the show. And I'm always getting emails from people who are emailing in for the first time, which is always great. Coming up straight after Unbelievable, well, not actually quite straight after Unbelievable, at 8 o'clock this evening here on Premier Christian Radio, Chad of the band King's K is going to be talking to Jess Lester on The Profile, talking about his life and faith there. So look out for that, or indeed on its own Profile podcast. Also well worth picking up last week's podcaster of The Profile. That was David Bennett talking to Sam Hales about his life as a gay Christian who's chosen a celibate path, and he's got a great book on that called A War of Loves. Let's go to some of your feedback. And so we'll start with Dr. Mark Pickering gets in touch. He's the chief executive of Christian Medical Fellowship here in the UK. Wants to talk about that show with Peter Hitchens and Christina Dent on drug legalization. And Mark says the debate on drug legalization was very important. Thanks so much for airing it. Like other respondents, I was frustrated by the way that the two respondents were basically talking past each other. But I think most listeners worked out that it's not a straight alternative of punish or rehabilitate. The answer must be both. As well as leading Christian Medical Fellowship in the UK, I work as a prison GP. Every day we see the effects of drug harms on the people that come into prison. The discussion focused mainly on cannabis, but the real hard end of drug harm is that wrought by drugs such as heroin and cocaine. These are terribly addictive, often lead to serious health consequences for those who use them, and also a huge burden of crime on others, often as addicts steal to pay for the drugs or injure others whilst under their influence. Very few people call for legalization of these drugs, but seeing the hard end of it helps to bring this debate into focus. One of my great sadnesses is that help and support is out there for those who struggle with addiction to these Class A drugs and their consequences, but often we lack a joined-up approach. Addicts often lead chaotic lives, and we see many who bounce between prison and homelessness or other precarious forms of living where community support services are sparse and under strain. There are fantastic stories of how people trapped in the grip of drug addiction can be helped out of it by loving, faithful support. Sometimes this needs residential drug rehab, which is often run by Christian organisations. There are also some wonderful stories of how people's lives are changed in prison by the work of chaplaincy teams. Sometimes it's only when our lives really hit rock bottom that we realise we need to look up from the gutter and cry out for help, often realising that the God who was always there offers us life-giving power to release us from the grip of addiction, and beyond that, to release us from the power of sin and death. Let's pray for those working in addiction services, especially Christians, as they bring hope and light to those in darkness. Keep going with the Unbelievable show, Justin. Almost 2 years ago, it quickly became one of my favourite podcasts, the original and best. Thank you very much, Mark. Great to hear from you. This one is from Chase in North Carolina, previously from Seattle. says, love what you're doing. Now, that war on drugs episode. Locking people in cages because of a plant is not Christian. We can get into the personal ethics of it as a discussion, no problem. But to reduce the value of a human life by throwing someone in a cage like an animal because of a plant is a disgrace. Now, onto the more concerning matter. Saying addiction isn't an actual medical condition is like saying depression or any other mental illness isn't real. You can look at thousands and thousands of peer-reviewed studies worldwide that say addiction and mental illness are both actual medical conditions, and the general consensus of almost all of science and medicine would agree as well. And then you quote from Matthew 25 about the stance Jesus has towards the suffering, sick and marginalized, where the king will say to those on his right, come you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance. For I was hungry, you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, you invited me in. I needed clothes and you clothed me. I was sick and you looked after me. Prison and you came to visit me. And the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did you see we see you hungry and feed you, thirsty, give you something to drink, a stranger invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you? And the king will reply, truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. And you conclude by saying, Chase, my prayer is that the mentally ill suffering from depression, anxiety and addiction are not the least of these that Peter Hitchens dismisses. If so, Peter Hitchens has dismissed Jesus Christ and the gospel altogether. Truly grateful for the work Christina is doing, bringing forth the kingdom and caring for addicts and broken and the least in an unusual but practical way. Thank you very much. Lots of response to that episode on drug addiction. Let's talk about the coronavirus. Where is God in a coronavirus world? We did that with John Lennox, but then I did my own take on this question of suffering, natural evil and coronavirus. That was a sort of just me on that podcast. And Graham wants to say lots of things I could pick up, but one thing stood out. The idea that the universe is out of kilter, as far as I can see, the universe is behaving exactly according to the natural laws it had from the beginning. The beginning is another discussion. There isn't a war going on. The universe is behaving exactly as it would, even if there were no humans to observe it. Plus, I would say there is absolutely no evidence of divine intervention. So for a religious person, the question of why did God create a universe with natural laws, which made earthquakes, tornadoes, viruses, and lumps of rock in space, which have caused catastrophic extinctions in the planet's history? It is the only physical universe. Is it the only physical universe that was possible to create? Is God bound by physics like the rest of us, or did he do it deliberately? So suffering was planned, as the Calvinists say. Anyway, back to decorating, says Graham. All good questions, Graham. I mean, as I said on the talk, the Bible seems to hint, and this is where we're coming from in the worldview of a Christian, that there was some sort of event, call it the fall or some kind of cosmic rebellion, that, as I use that phrase, put the universe out of kilter. And it could be that those effects are both forward reaching and past reaching, but there's something about the way things are that we sense isn't the way things should be. Death is the final enemy, as the Bible says, and yet death is somehow part and parcel of the way this universe operates. And so I suppose, you know, it is one of those things where I do say, actually, I do believe in this promise of Scripture that the world will one day be renewed, remade in a way where death is no longer the enemy, where every tear is wiped away, and where we aren't, if you like, in conflict with nature in the way that we are, you know, in everything we do. Could God have made it a different way? I don't know. I mean, perhaps there is a case for saying it's part of what it is to be human, to go through that, to kind of be shaped and molded by it. But I don't believe in a sense that God intends for us to, I don't think God is the author of evil in that sense, but I do believe God can use even the evil circumstances, as I said in the talk, to bring us to a knowledge of himself and to be fully human. Appreciate though that you just see it as you know, what happens, happens. And that is the atheist worldview. I understand that. Here's a Christian though, who disagrees with me as well. David Carter says, I listened to the coronavirus episode with interest and puzzlement. Why? Well, earlier this year, you introduced listeners to the work of Thomas Ord in a conversation with he and someone else who had a spiritual warfare understanding of evil. Well, Tom's argument and presentation really interested me. And since then, I've read his two major books, The Uncontrolling Love of God and God Can't, on a couple of occasions. As a keen reader, a pastor and amateur theologian, it's quite uncommon for me to read and reread in a short space of time. I am about as convinced as I can be that his approach to evil suffering, chance and Good God, make the best emotional and intellectual sense of a problem that has haunted humanity forever. So I was surprised you didn't mention his work, but seemed to fall back on the spiritual warfare view. Tom's work insists on the priority of God as love and allows for a universe which is evolving, not in God's control, and yet providence is at work in all things. Often enjoy listening to your podcast, but none has made the impact that listening to Tom has. It certainly made me stop and think further about God, life, love, and suffering. So why doesn't God stop coronavirus? Simply, God can't. Says David. David, first of all, I'm glad that you obviously got so much from that episode with Tom Auden. It's led you on a journey to exploring more of that way of looking at it. All I can honestly say to you in response to why didn't I mention his work is because I guess I don't find myself as convinced as you do on that front. I just find that the warfare view makes more sense of what I see around me. And the biblical text as well. So in a sense, my sympathies lay with the other debate partner in that case. But I appreciate you getting in touch. And obviously that for you has become a very important way of looking at the subject. Lots more that could be said, but here's one more from Dallas in Fort Worth in Dallas, Texas. This is Roger Price, who says, I was a special education teacher for 44 years working with broken and fragile children. I also taught gifted and talented kids in the public schools. I got to see both ends of the spectrum, so to speak. I am also legally blind since birth with very little optical correction. I read with a 5x pocket magnifier and audiobooks as I can find them. Our 6-year-old son and only child, Eric, died of a horrible form of cancer when he was 6. I'm now approaching 77 years of age. I want you to know that over the last few years, foremost among the people who have helped me immeasurably is yourself and Dr. John Lennox. Today, I'm pre-ordering John's new book, which you've recorded, so I will get the CD as well. In your most recent YouTube, you discussed COVID-19. I was so impressed with the comprehensive nature of your treatment of the subject, as well as the tenderness and sensitivity. I trusted the Lord Jesus as Saviour when I was 7, and he has been my comfort and guide all these years. You're in my prayers every single day, and I thank God for your work. God bless you, Roger. Thank you so much for getting in touch. And I will pass your message on to John as well. I'm sure he'll be delighted to know that that what he's written has been such a help as well. What an extraordinary story and life you have had. But I'm so glad that you've been able to see it in the light of your faith in Christ. And so, absolutely humbled to receive that message. So, and you mentioned you've let the cat out of the bag a bit there. You mentioned that you've pre-ordered John's new book, and the one you're referring to there, I think it must be actually his forthcoming book, which is all about AI, artificial intelligence. It's called 2084. And yes, I have recorded the audiobook version of that for John, which I was delighted to do, only very recently completed that actually. So, but that will be available in the not too distant future. So glad you're going to be able to get hold of that one. Well, lots more that could be said. We've got your all your texts and emails on meaning, but we are running fast out of time here. So maybe we'll hold those over for next week. Your responses to that show of last week, Zach Broom and Michael Brady on how do atheists get their meaning. We will do those next week. So feel free to send more of those in. Feel free to send in your thoughts on today's show as well. I'd be interested to hear what you made of Paul Loggia and Sean McDowell's debate on the fate of the apostles. Email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk or get in touch via the social media. All of the links available as ever for today's show and my guests at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, including how to register for the webinar on unlocking apologetics in the era of COVID-19 with special guest John Lennox. Just before we close out, a reminder that I've also got a charity head shave coming up on Sunday the 17th of May. If you'd like to get involved and donate something towards a very worthy cause, Christian Aid Week coming up, I'm going to be having my head shaved on Sunday the 17th of May at around 12 noon UK, straight after our live stream church service from our front room. We're going to keep the camera rolling and my wife is going to do the business with the clippers. She's never used a pair before. I'm frankly terrified of what could happen and indeed what it'll look like afterwards. But we are doing it to raise money for a good cause. If you'd like to get involved, there is a link in the podcast info where you can donate towards this. And you're very welcome to tune in live when it's happening on Sunday, the 17th of May. That's all from me for this week. Let me tell you what's coming up next time. Okay. Okay, my bad. I don't know what's coming up next time. The fact is, I had a show lined up and then it can't happen for various reasons. So we're going to pull something together. Not exactly sure right now what it is, but we will bring something to you next week for Unbelievable. In the meantime, I hope your lockdown is going well, that you're surviving and thriving through this coronavirus. For now, thank you very much for listening. And we'll see you next time. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.